Imagine you're a young, studious, hard-working Brahmin boy in colonial India, all set to become a barrister. Your marriage already announced. And suddenly something untoward happens to you. We know where this is going now, don't we? Namaskaram, listeners. Mr. Jeeva here. Tonight's ghost story puts us in the shoes, or rather, the bare feet of our central Marathi ghost, making us deal with his horrifying, vengeful existence. A darkly comical and twisted tale brought to you by author C.A. Kincaid, with editions from yours truly, ominously titled Munja. Munja by C.A. Kincaid, adapted for podcast format by Nishtha Jeeva. It was a stuffy September afternoon in Nasik. Rain had not fallen for some days, and even before that, it had been far below the average. Indeed, there had at one time been so great a dread of a famine that the priests of Ramchandra's temple had for 24 consecutive hours kept their most important idol from resting by pouring cold water over it at short intervals. The suggestion had been made by the English judge, who was immensely respected as a learned Sanskrit scholar. He had supported his suggestion by so many quotations from the Vedas and Puranas, the Hindu Gospels and epistles, that the priests had, although with diffidence, followed the Englishman's advice. Its value had been fully vindicated, for within the 24 hours, a heavy thunderstorm had burst. The week's steady downpour had followed, and the earth, soaked with 6 inches of precious rain, had lost its iron crust, and although still thirsting, had become soft enough for the early monsoon sowing. Thus, for the present, there was no immediate danger of a famine, but sporadic cases of plague had occurred, and one of the unlucky sufferers was a young Brahmin boy of great promise called Mahadev Joshi. He was a Deshasth Brahmin, and his school career had been brilliant. He had carried off all the prizes at the Nasik High School could offer. From school, he had entered the Deccan College near Pune, and there had taken a brilliant first class in mathematics. He had distinguished himself at games as well, and Dr. Selby, the principal of the Deccan College, who loved Mahadev as his own son, had offered him the post of junior professor in mathematics. But the young Brahmin was attracted to the bar, for which his penetrating intellect and perfect knowledge of English were admirably adapted. He presented himself for High Court Pleader's examination and passed it with exceptional brilliancy. Weary of study and anxious to see his parents and friends, he had returned to Nasik, the beautiful town near the source of the Godavari River. There, after 3 weeks of delightful, restful idleness, he had contracted plague. There was nothing strange that he should have done so, for his family house was an old wada mansion, dating from the time of the Peshwas, and was overrun with rats. The rats were infested with fleas. The fleas settled on the bare feet of the members of the family, and thus spread infection. First a servant, next a distant cousin, got plague. They did not die of it, but they helped to spread the disease. So that when young Mahadev came to the old family house for a holiday, run down from overwork and too little sleep, he was a likely victim. Mahadev's father Balwant Rao and his mother Saraswati Bai nursed their sick son with anxious devotion. The father was weighed down by the natural fears that any father would feel for the life of his brilliant son. In the mother's anxiety was a more sinister element. Mahadev had been invested with the sacred thread at the age of 12, and thus had been initiated to the Brahmin caste. By the rules of orthodox Hinduism, and Nasik is very orthodox, Mahadev should have been married at 15. This is what his mother most ardently wished. Indeed, the question of his marriage had been fully discussed, and he was betrothed to Narmada Bai, the pretty daughter of the leading criminal pleader of Ahmednagar. But old Balwant Rao Joshi, greedily ambitious for his son's school and college successes, put off the marriage on various pretexts. His wish was to keep the boy unmarried until his examinations were over. These had now been successfully passed, and Balwant Rao had drafted wedding invitations that a Bombay printing press would print on cards in big gold letters. Nevertheless, the marriage ceremonies had not begun when Mahadev fell ill, and Saraswati Bai was tortured with the thought that if her son died unmarried, he would die a Munja, a Brahmin boy invested with a sacred thread, but still a bachelor. She held the vulgar belief that in that event, Mahadev's soul would become a vile, evil spirit, deprived of rebirth because his parents had sinned in delaying his marriage. Her darling son would haunt a peepal tree and, feared and cursed by every human being, would rush at intervals from his dwelling place and play a horrible trick on some unfortunate person walking close to his tree. His only chance of escape was to possess some wayfarer's body, but she knew how difficult that was. She, therefore, prayed and prayed to Vishnu and Ganpati, to Shiva and Parvati, and to every other god she could think of, even the graceless Shanidev, Saturn, that her son might recover at any rate and live long enough to marry Narmada Bai. The sick boy was well looked after, as well as any English patient would have been. The civil surgeon was called in consultation, and under his supervision, the local practitioner wrote out correct prescriptions. Unhappily, there are no specific remedies for plague. What is needed is a perfectly sound constitution, helped by good nursing. Mahadev's mother and sisters were present at his bedside night and day, so he did not lack good nursing. Thanks to their ceaseless vigilance, the buboes under his armpits grew smaller and smaller, and the sick boy smiled and even laughed, his gaiety spreading joy through the whole household. Then one day, he sat up for his morning tea, his mother's arm round his neck. He was bending his head forward to sip it, when suddenly, he fell forward, knocking the cup and saucer out of her hand. She turned to the towel stand close by for a towel to dry her son's hands and chest. As she did so, Mahadev's body twisted round and fell, so that he hung half in bed and half out of bed. In wild despair, Saraswati called to her husband.
"Come, come, come,"
she screamed.
"Mahadev has fallen. He's very ill."
Old Balwant Rao was deeply immersed in an article in the Kesari newspaper, condemning vigorously some measure or other proposed by the government of India. Nevertheless, he dropped his paper and ran up the uncarpeted wooden stairs which led to the sleeping rooms. There, he saw Mahadev hanging motionless out of bed and Saraswati lying prostrate on his body. He murmured in Marathi,
"Kai sale? What has happened?"
Going to the bedside, he lifted his son back into bed and felt his wrist. Afterwards, he put his hand on Mahadev's heart. Both pulse and heart were still. With the calm self-mastery of the Deccan Brahmin, Balwant Rao said in even tones,
"As it seems to me, Mahadev is dead."
Saraswati, whole mad with grief, screamed at her husband.
"Yes, he's dead. And thanks to your wicked ideas, he's dead, unmarried, a Munja. A Munja. And he will live on as an evil spirit long after we have died and we have been reborn."
"Nonsense, nonsense. Why believe in such childish tales? Munjas do not become evil spirits. That is a mere fable. In any case," he added by way of compromise, "if Mahadev does become a demon, we can always appease him by offering him rice and grain, or even a fowl now and then."
No words of Balwant Rao, however soothing, could lessen the poor mother's grief. Had her darling son died married, she would probably have borne her sorrow and survived. But the dreadful thought that her beloved son should, from being an universal favorite in school, college, and in Nasik society, become a hateful phantom, prove too much for Saraswati. When Balwantrao and the male mourners returned from the burning ground, whither they had taken Mahadev's body, they found his mother lying face downwards at the bottom of the stairs. A cerebral hemorrhage had overtaken her as she was walking up to take a last look at her son's room. She had fallen backwards and broken her neck in her fall. A day later, her body was carried to the same burning ground wherein Mahadev's had already been consumed. Poor old Balwantrao shaved his head and mustaches and observed the usual 12 days mourning. He sought refuge from his grief in the devotion of his daughters and in the study of sacred Sanskrit books, and he gave little thought to the question that the other townspeople were feverishly asking each other: where will the Munja take up his abode? For many days after the death of Mahadev, the Nasik townsmen put red-painted stones at the foot of various peepal trees in the neighborhood of the town. One or two trees near Nasik were, it was believed, already occupied by Munjas, and they received due homage and small daily offerings of rice. It never occurred to any of the citizens that the new Munja would go any distance from the city. They did not bear in mind that Mahadev, who had often mixed with Englishmen and liked them, might well establish himself near the quarter where they lived. One evening, two or three tongas, filled with respectable Brahmins of Nasik and their wives and families, set out about 10 p.m. to catch the midnight express from Nasik Road Station. The train reached Bombay at 8 a.m. Next morning and night travel saved the passengers, all of whom slept well in trains. The hot day journey down the Ghats and through the Konkan Plain. The third-class carriages can be very stuffy by day, and Indian children suffer a good deal from the heat. The road to the station ran west of the Nasik golf course, used alike by Bombay visitors and Nasik residents. Between the road and the links stood a giant peepal tree. It was full moon, and the travelers were laughing and talking together, holding in their hands endless bundles of bedding and balancing their sterns precariously on innumerable tin trunks and brass water pots. As the tongas passed the peepal tree, the ponies took fright, and galloping madly off the road and across the open country, they did not stop until they had overturned the tongas into a ravine a mile away. No fewer than two children and a young woman were killed outright. One man had a compound fracture of the leg. A second had his arm broken, and everyone, including the drivers, was badly shaken and injured. The ponies were put on their feet, shivering with fright, but beyond a few slight cuts were not badly injured. The police were sent for. The dead were transported to the mortuary near the civil hospital. The injured were handed over to the care of the house surgeon, and next day, the police inspector held an inquest. There was, however, little to record save the bare facts of the accident. The oldest Brahmin assured the inspector that he had heard a blood-curdling shriek, and that in the moonlight he had seen a monstrous, diabolical figure issue from the peepal tree and deliberately scare the ponies. In his judgment, the phantom was the soul of Mahadev, the Munja that had taken up an abode in the peepal tree on the golf course. The Brahmin was corroborated by one or two of the women and one of the older men. Nevertheless, the inspector refused to put into his report anything about the Munja. He had experienced the unpleasant skepticism of English officials, and he knew well that any reference to such a phenomenon would only be treated by his English superior as damned native superstition, and that he himself would get a wigging for writing rubbish in an inquest report. The refusal of the inspector to record the evidence of the elderly Brahmin was fully understood by the Nasik townsmen, and they were not annoyed by it. After all, what could the superintendent do? Even if he knew that a Munja haunted the peepal tree, he might have the tree cut down, but that would only infuriate the demon who lived in it. Mahadev's soul would seek some other hiding place, and issuing therefrom would cause worse trouble than before. No, the townsman's course was clear. They knew now where the Munja dwelt, and it was for them to propitiate him by worshipping him as a god, by placing beneath his tree stones painted with the royal red of divinity, by offering him daily small portions of rice, and by burning nightly in his honor small single wick lamps full of country oil. Such attention might well have soothed the irascible spirit of any ordinary Munja, but Mahadev, whose acute intelligence had survived his body, knew well that such offerings, although pleasing, got a Munja nowhere. His only chance of obtaining a speedy rebirth and thus advancing toward the end of his 80 million earthly lives was to enter and possess some other human body and then cause its destruction. There were several ways of possessing a human body, but only one was easy, and that was to enter the mouth when its owner yawned. Mahadev, no longer anxious to do anyone harm now that offerings were made at the foot of the peepal tree, hovered about the neighborhood, hoping to take advantage of some passing Indian and to possess his body when he yawned. Unfortunately, every Indian is well aware of the risks run in yawning and always snaps his fingers in front of his mouth so as to scare away evil spirits. For a whole month, Mahadev's spirit fluttered close to the faces of passing wayfarers, but no one gave him a chance. They did not often yawn, but when they did, they never failed to snap their fingers and to scare him away. At last, seeing a solitary Englishman yawn cavernously in the distance, it occurred to Mahadev that he might possess an Englishman's body, since he could not enter an Indian's. At first, the thought was hateful to him, although he had often met Englishmen, and like many of them, he had always remained orthodox in food, and the thought of occupying the body of a beef-eating foreigner was simply hateful. Nevertheless, he decided at last that it was better to enter an Englishman's body and drive out his soul than remain forever in anima sin corpore, gibbering dismally in a peepal tree. When, however, he lay in wait for Englishmen playing golf, he found another obstacle in his way. When they yawned, especially if they were not alone, they put a hand in front of their mouth, thus blocking the entrance quite as effectively as by snapping their fingers. Still, Mahadev had seen one Englishman yawn without covering his mouth, so he hoped that he would see another, and so what happened. After several days of vain waiting, Mahadev saw the assistant judge, Colin Travers, pass close to the peepal tree. Travers had come out of court late and had therefore found no partner at the clubhouse. He was tired with work and had a yawning fit. As he passed the peepal tree, he yawned for about the 10th time. He was carrying in one hand a mashie and in the other a bag of clubs, so he had no hand left with which to cover his mouth. It opened to its fullest extent and offered a wide aperture by which Mahadev could enter. The Munja dived between the double row of strong white teeth down the throat, and while Colin Travers was laying down his bag of clubs and wondering whether he should play his next shot with his mashie or his iron, the evil spirit that had been Mahadev drove out Colin Travers' soul and occupied the vacant body. The physical shock to Travers was so great that he sat down helplessly at the foot of the peepal tree and gasped feebly for breath. Once, however, he recovered his physical powers. He became the tool of Mahadev's spirit and obeyed without hesitation the Munja's slightest whim. Indeed, why should he have objected? His own soul was lost and had no longer any control over his body. On the other hand, Mahadev's soul completely dominated it. Now what Mahadev wanted was that his new body should be destroyed. His own spirit would then be free for rebirth. There were two ways by which the Munja could achieve his end. He might either kill himself or he might commit a murder and get hanged. Now in the Hindu belief system, suicide, Atmaghat, is a grave sin. And Mahadev had already committed sin enough by entering the soul of an Englishman. In his next life, he would be certainly having to pay for that crime by not being born a Brahmin. If he committed suicide as well, heaven alone knew what dreadful fate might befall him. He might be reborn as a Mar, or even worse, Zamang. His only resource, therefore, was to commit a murder and so get condemned to death. Having formed this resolve, he picked up his clubs and, walking towards the assistant judge's bungalow, entered it. The servants, seeing, as they thought, their master to cover two sheets of foolscap with material that a skilled writer could have expanded into a thick book, the unhappy Superintendent Charles had chewed his wooden pen holder almost down to the metal. He was too preoccupied to grasp what Travers had said, but delighted to escape for a moment from the intolerable drudgery of writing sonorous official phrases, he rose to his feet and said cordially,
"By Jove, Travers, do come in. Sit down and have a whiskey and soda. Here, boy, bring in two chota pegs. I suppose you have come to speak to me about the police inquiry in that coining case. Or, let me see, would it be about the murder of little Krishnabai by that upcountry watchman?"
"No, indeed. I have not come about either of those cases, Superintendent Sahib," said Travers, using unconsciously the Indian form of address. "I have just committed a double murder, and I've come to give myself up."
"Committed a double murder? What the devil are you talking about? If you have come to pull my leg, old chap, I really have no time now, and you'd better try your luck some other day. But don't go away until you've had your chota peg. It's no fun drinking alone, is it?"
And the jolly policeman laughed heartily. "No, Superintendent Sahib, I am not joking. I really have committed a double murder, and please come and see for yourself." After a quarter of an hour, Dawkins, clad in white uniform and followed by four constables, joined Travers.
"Now, come along and show me this mare's nest of yours."
Travers did not reply, and the two walked together in silence during the 10 minutes needed to go from the superintendent's office to that of the assistant judge. On reaching it, they were met by a mob of excited servants who shouted,
"The sahib has killed his maim sahib, and the doctor maim sahib also."
The superintendent began at last to think that there was something in Travis's story, and entering the assistant judge's bungalow, became certain of its truth. Turning to one of the constables, Dawkins told him to fetch the deputy superintendent of police, Khan Sahib Mahmood Khan, and instruct him to hold an inquest. With two constables behind them, he and Travers walked to the Khan Bahadur's house. The latter, a retired Parsi deputy collector, nearly fell over backwards when he was asked to record Travers's confession.
"The fact was," stated Travers, "I was both tired of my wife and jealous of her. I wanted to get rid of her. I also wished to punish her for the way she flirted with
The Munja did not know the names of any of the regimental officers, so he finished lamely,
"with certain military gentlemen. Coming home, I saw her sitting in the drawing room, so I decided to kill her. I took a dacoit's dagger from off the wall, and going up to her, I stabbed her. Then that foolish woman, Miss Smith, began to talk. You know how these medical missionaries jabber? So I killed her too."
The confession was carefully recorded. Travers was placed in the lockup for the night. The next morning, he was taken before the first-class assistant collector, to whom the superintendent had telegraphed. He recorded the Crown evidence as briefly as possible, and when Travers pleaded guilty to the two charges of murder and admitted the correctness of his confession, the magistrate committed the accused to take his trial in the High Court of Bombay. On the morning of Travers's trial, there was great excitement in the Presidency town. The Sessions Hall of the High Court of Judicature was packed to overflowing. Indeed, hundreds of would-be spectators were turned away. Travers's trial was the first on the list of criminal trials. The judge to whom the sessions had been allotted sat in state in his red robes under the sword of justice. On either side sat the sheriff and the chief presidency magistrate. As Travers was English, the jury of 9 selected to find on his guilt or innocence were also English. He had refused to engage a barrister, so one of the European members of the bar, who knew him personally, undertook voluntarily his defense. It was impossible for his counsel to do much, because Travers, from the beginning, insisted on pleading guilty. The medical evidence, too, confirmed the accused's protest that he was absolutely sane.
The barrister for the defense could only rely on the passage in Travers's confession that he was jealous and attempted to reduce the charge from one of murder to one of culpable homicide. But as the Advocate General pointed out, Travers's jealousy of his wife was no excuse for the assassination of Miss Smith. The judge summed up shortly, and the jury, after an absence of barely 10 minutes, brought in a verdict that Travers was guilty of murder, but added to their verdict a strong recommendation for mercy. Why they did so, they would probably have found it hard to explain. The real reason, no doubt, was that in their belief, no sane man could have behaved like Travers. If Travers was sane, then all the facts had not been put before the court. The judge was glad of an excuse not to pass sentence of death on a man whom he knew personally and whom he had until recently always esteemed. So much to Travers's obvious disgust, he passed a sentence of penal servitude for life. The accused was led away, and the judge called the next case. Travers was sent to jail, and from the first was an object of special interest to the superintendent, Captain Jameson of the Indian Medical Service. Jameson had never met Travers before, but he felt that there must be some terrible secret underlying his conduct. The prison staff took their cue from the superintendent. Travers responded to kindness, and the jail officials all thought that he was the nicest as well as the most intelligent prisoner whom they had ever had at Euroda. It was, however, only the lull before the storm. The Munja had not the slightest intention of remaining imprisoned in Travis's body a moment longer than he could help. If two murders did not suffice to procure a death sentence, then he would commit three. The third would certainly bring him release, for murder by a life convict can, under the Indian Penal Code, only be punished by death. One day, Travers asked if he might have a pair of Indian clubs for morning exercise, as, so he said, his health was suffering from lack of it. He had always been accustomed to swing them for half an hour every morning. Jameson was delighted to grant this trifling indulgence, and as he had a spare pair in his bungalow, he brought them over the same evening and gave them to Travers. Travers broke into profuse thanks so as to disarm any possible fears on the superintendent's part. Picking up the clubs, he swung them once over his shoulder and then brought down with all his force the right-hand club on the top of Jameson's head. The unfortunate officer fell with a broken skull, and a second blow, as he lay on the hard stone flagged courtyard, shattered it to pieces. "Now," thought the Munja in triumph, "I am bound to be hanged." No one, however, came forward to arrest him. The guards were all too bewildered to take any action. Then the joy of battle, inherited from Travers's Norse ancestors, acted physically on Mahadev's soul. After all, why await trial? Why not go on killing until death comes of itself? With a club in each hand, Travers fell on the unfortunate Maratha guard, who scattered in every direction. Running after them at great speed, Travers overtook several and with mighty blows clubbed them to death. The Indian convicts, locked into their cells, were in an ecstasy of delight. They applauded each murderous blow with yells of,
"Shabash sir! Maro sir!"
After Travers had killed half a dozen sepoys, those on duty at the outer gate ran up the staircase into the central tower, whence they commanded all the open spaces of the great prison. From this vantage point, they took careful aim with their rifles and fired deliberately at Travers. It was not easy to kill him, because he was moving about, and also because in his berserk rage, he did not seem to be affected by the bullet wounds. At last, he collapsed suddenly from loss of blood. As he lay motionless, The guards fired a volley at him. He gave a convulsive movement, tried to rise, and fell back dead. All the Englishmen who had known Travers were deeply shocked at his crimes and death. Such a terrible end to a most promising career, they said. Travers might have risen to anything. He must have been mad, but it was a dreadful end. Yes, they were quite right. It was a dreadful end. A terrible end. Mahadev's soul knew a thing or two about a promising career. But that is not his concern now. At last, the Munja had won the desired release. As Travis's body lay there, with its eyes fully open, Mahadev inside was peering out through them like he used to peer out through the windows of a first-class railway coach. The view of the outsider looking back at his own world. But he would be having no more of that. His soul would now leave the Englishman's body and take its place in the line of Hindu souls waiting for reincarnation. And the subtleties of that process, the Munja was least expecting. A head of a buffalo creeped into his view, horns first, long and curved. It gazed intently into his eyes. Was it the soul of the buffalo the wretched beef-eater had slain and consumed, he thought. As the head of the buffalo veered more into his frame, Mahadev saw with horror that the head was attached to a well-built human body. It leapt to his side to take his club, and then started clubbing his chest. Mahadev, who had never priorly felt the senses of the Englishman, started to feel every blow on his shattering chest. The creature then reached for Travis's heart and pulled. As the organ was held in the air, Mahadev was pleased to find the body of Travis lifted up with it, attached by loose tissue. Mahadev was seeing through it no more. He would be born a Brahmin again, while the beef-eater would languish in Naraka for all eternity. After the quick tryst with one of the minions of Yama, the Lord of Death, Mahadev felt his soul start to rise. His soul felt elated that he was reaching Swarga, which he thought to be an even better deal. He felt his view scour the lands he once knew and grew up in. Then his soul suddenly whisked off into the dingy streets that populated his childhood memories. And then, a field. He was looking back at the peopled tree where his monstrous escapades were spent. Mahadev saw a glowing light. There? Again? He then saw that at the foot of the tree, two dogs were mating. The heavenly glow seemed to be coming from their act of rushed coitus. His soul was being sucked into that light. But Mahadev Joshi was supposed to be reborn. Reborn into a Brahmin boy. At least hopefully. The glowing light overpowered his extraterrestrial senses. And he saw no more.
By Jove, he finally opened his eyes. Been 2 weeks since the mutt was born, innit? Hey, boy, 2 jotapegs for the missus and me.
Superintendent Charles exclaimed, looking at the young puppy. Mahadev could finally see in his new body after being born blind. He initially had some visions of his past life, but those have now gone away. He padded around toward his canine mother and then his new human master, struggling, albeit quickly learning to walk on his fours. Mahadev then wagged his tiny tail.
He learns pretty quickly, eh? Clever mutt, this one. Could teach him a lot of new tricks like we did our Bernard.
Mahadev Joshi, like always, held great promise. His reincarnation was finally complete.